Hello, everybody. Welcome to our Anxiety Forum. We're glad that you're here tonight. I'm Sharon Coleman. I'm one of the pastors here at PVCC, and we are very delighted that you're here, especially if you're a visitor, someone who's maybe never come to PVC before, especially welcome to you, and thanks so much for coming. So we are here tonight, as you know, to have a discussion about anxiety. And Sean Reese, one of our pastors, has been preaching on this for the last couple of weeks from Matthew 6. And we know that anxiety affects all of us to some extent, but for some, it really has a great impact on our lives. And so the leadership team here at PVC really does recognize this, and that's why we have these forums. We try to have forums periodically on kind of hot topics because we want to be a church that's relevant and that talks about things that affect our daily lives. And we know that anxiety is definitely one of those topics. As a staff, we have often talked about how we're seeing anxiety in the children, in the Sunday school program, in the youth, in young adults, and all the way up to elderly adults, right? It doesn't seem to know any limits at all. We can all be affected by anxiety. And naturally, as Christ followers, we want to know how to respond appropriately and with compassion. And so hopefully tonight, we will learn even more about how to do that to help those who are suffering. And so hopefully everyone will go home with some guidance and some new tools in their toolbox tonight. So let me tell you a little bit about our schedule. We will have a panel come up in just a minute when I'm finished, and they will have a presentation for you, probably for about 40, 45 minutes. And then we're going to take a 10-minute break, and hopefully each of you got a little card as you came in. That is to give you an opportunity to write down a question or two. So as you're hearing things, if a question comes to you, go ahead and write that on the card, and when they're finished with their presentation, I'll come back up, and I'll give you instructions on how to turn those in. And then we'll take a 10-minute break. You will be able to get up, move around the cabin, go to the restroom, whatever, and then we'll come back after that 10 minutes, and we'll have compiled your questions, come up with the ones that we have in common and that we can do tonight, and do as many of them as we can, and then I'll read the questions, we'll pose those to our panel, and we'll get all the answers, right? and then we will probably, this will be a chance for you to ask your questions anonymously, and then we'll probably finish around 8:30, 8:45, because we know it feels like even an hour later tonight, so we don't want to keep you too late. So Janie Sachs, I'll just have Janie stand up. Some of you have met Janie before because she's come and done some events for us. We had her at an R&R that many of us remember. And so Janie and I met at least 6 months ago to start talking about tonight. And I just enjoy her tremendously. And we had a good time brainstorming and talking through things. And so I'm really excited that tonight is here. And then she gathered this team to come and present for you. And then we also have our own Dr. Nellie Fu here tonight. So I'll have her stand up. And of course, she's a PVC attender who will be off to Carnegie Hall with the choir later this month. But she will be here in case we need her, the psychiatrist that can help us if any of the questions warrant that. So thank you to all of you. Thank you for being here. And let me just open our time with prayer, and then I'm going to bring the panel on up to get us started. Well, Lord, we do thank you for this night. We thank you for this opportunity to gather and to learn. We just pray that your presence would indeed be felt here tonight. We welcome you among us, and we pray for your guidance. We pray that you would guide and lead the panel as they share with us, and just cause each of us to learn something tonight that will help us and or someone else. So give us ears to hear. We just raise this time to you and thank you for this tremendous opportunity you've given us tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. So come on up. And they're going to sit here on the stools, and I'm going to let Janie introduce them all to you.
Hello. Well, you guys can take a seat. Sharon, when Sharon and I talked, I think it was actually a little more even than 6 months ago, but I asked her if she would let us release a whole bunch of rats in this building to see how you guys all handled your anxiety, but she said no, it wasn't a good idea. So you guys are in luck. I just want to first just say thank you for having us. It was such a privilege to be with Sharon, and those of us who are here from the Christian Counseling Center find it such a privilege to share with you something that we're so passionate about. We are a center that's in San Jose, and we see a lot of different clientele. Someone was just asking me, we have, you know, oftentimes people say, well, counseling is kind of out of my financial reach. And we have therapists who see clients starting at $40 and all the way up, and even a sliding scale from there. So I just wanted to tell you that just from the start, if something in this, you know, begins to stir in you and you feel like you need to talk to someone, I just want you to know that that is available. So I'm going to go ahead and everybody introduce themselves. I was going to have them say their greatest anxiety, because that's what therapists do when we talk to each other. You know, we go as deep as possible, but Rob said no. So anyway, I'm going to just have them introduce themselves to you. Your greatest anxiety.
Oh my gosh.
Is here now, right? So, my name is Janie Sachs, as Sharon already introduced me, and I've been at the Christian Counseling Center for 10 years.
Hi, I'm Morgan. I'm an associate marriage and family therapist, and I've been at CCC for a month.
My name is Rob Grellman, and I've been at CCC for nearly 20 years.
I'm Claudio Silva. I'm at CCC since 2010.
And my name's Allison. I've been at CCC for about 16 months, and I too am an associate marriage and family therapist. And what that means is that we are, Morgan and I, are on our way to be licensed. We have graduated with our master's, and they make us get 3,000 hours before we can be licensed. So we're on our way towards that.
Thank you. So I just want to start out and think about, when we think about anxiety, often we think about the negative aspects of anxiety, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But I believe, and I think we all know, that God has actually given us a healthy piece of anxiety, a healthy anxiety that says, yes, if we released rats into this building, not that you would be in danger, but, you know, you would react. A healthy anxiety that says, I better not cross the street without looking first. A healthy anxiety that says, I have to take a test, I better study for it. And so we have a really good sense of, God has given us this to watch out for danger, to be careful. And so if we didn't have that, it wouldn't be a very good thing. I want to tell you a little bit about anxiety from just my own perspective. I remember it was about 13 years ago that I sort of began to realize that, wow, I really struggle with anxiety. And it was actually in church. For about 6 weeks, every time I went to church, I had an anxiety attack. And I was trying to figure out, like, what is the deal with this? Like, I'm in church and I have to stand up. I can't sit down and talk. and I'm in church and I can't, I feel really uncomfortable here. And so it began to be this journey for me of trying to figure out, what is my anxiety about? Where does it come from? And just that feeling of, wow, you know, I go to church and they tell me not to be anxious, and here I am in church and I'm anxious. And so I went down this long road of figuring out I have anxiety in my family and had to figure out some ways to deal with that. And but just want to say that to you to say, it's really, there's so many of us who struggle with anxiety. And even in church, when we hear, don't be anxious, and I would get anxious because I was anxious. And so such a normal response to anxiety. I just want you to know, too, tonight, we have so much to cover. We could actually probably do like 6 weeks of this. So we are going to skim the surface. So you will, like Sharon said, have time for questions. I'm going to just play. This next slide is just going to be just a short clip of some things that if you struggle with anxiety, you might think about, or if you don't and you know someone who does, this may be some things that are going on for them. So I'm going to just give you a little bit about what anxiety is. And these are not clinical definitions, but I think they help us understand what anxiety actually is or what it feels like. Overactive brain and or your brain never stops running. Sort of like that feeling of like you have an engine on and it just won't turn off. You go to bed at night, it won't turn off. Or it'll go off for a time and then at 2 or 3 or 4 a.m. it turns back on and you can try everything under the sun and it does not feel like it will ever turn off. Fear, false expectations appearing real. Anxiety lives in the irrational. One of my places of anxiety that I lovingly inherited from my mom is in health. Oftentimes when I get a cold or I get the flu, I'm pretty sure that something terrible, awful is going to happen to me and I'm not going to be around for very long, which sounds really silly, but it feels very real to me. And that's what anxiety feels like to people. It might be health in the place of health. It might be wealth or your finances. I have worked with people who have worried about, and now that this has happened often, but school shootings, teens, kids are afraid that someone's going to come in at their school. My daughter actually, a couple of years back, had a fear that an airplane was going to go down and land on her. Now, it doesn't make a sense. Again, it's sort of irrational, but that's where anxiety lives. For some people, and maybe for some of you here, it was a really big deal for you to come here tonight. Going out and being in a social place with other people is terrifying to you. And so for some people, that's how their anxiety shows up. For others, there's just excessive thoughts about all different kinds of things. Their brain is just constantly going. Maybe it's about losing your job, or other people aren't going to like you, or your children, or on and on and on and on. I could go on all night long with a list of that. Kind of like your brain gets locked into this place. I like this little thing, me, what could possibly go wrong? And anxiety says, I'm glad you asked. One of the things that we like to talk about as therapists is catastrophic thinking, and that's sort of what this is. You know, it's that kind of thing where you take something and, well, you know, I could not do that great on a test. Well, if I don't do that great on a test, then my teacher's not going to like me. And if she doesn't like me, then maybe she's not going to write a good review for me. And then I'm not going to be able to go to college. And then I'm not going to be able to do life. And, you know, on and on and on it goes. And so we all have a tendency to do that. And anxiety, catastrophic thinking, we often take many, many things into a catastrophic place. What's the worst possible thing that could happen? And that's where our brain likes to go. I like this next one too. My anxieties have anxieties. One of the things we know in particular about panic is that when someone has their first panic attack, or many people get almost more worried about having another panic attack than they do about their anxiety, because it's terrifying to have a panic attack. And so this could, you know, go for many things. I'm anxious about my relationships. And so we become anxious about the anxieties versus just, you know, it's this like, woo, keeps on going, going, going. And then the last one, anxiety is not being able to sleep because you said something wrong 2 years ago and can't stop thinking about it. So one of the things that I love about this is that we often think that anxiety is here, right? Like, it's in my head. It's in my brain. But anxiety shows up in our bodies as well. One of the people who I have, his name is Dr. David Grand, and he talks about how what's in the brain is in the body, and what's in the body is in the brain. And so thinking about the physical symptoms that people have about anxiety that often we don't pay attention to, they might be sleep problems. They might be that you can't stay still and calm. Maybe you have cold, sweaty, tingly, or numb hands or feet. Maybe you have shortness of breath or heart palpitations. Maybe you feel nauseous, or you have tense muscles, or you feel dizzy. We often have these sorts of things happening in our body, and we don't connect it at all to the fact, like, wow, I'm really anxious about this. And so we're just disconnected from our body. But what is in our brain is in our body, and what's in our body is in our brain. I just want to give you some facts about anxiety. Anxiety disorders are the most common mental illness in the U.S., affecting 40 million adults, 18 and over, or 18.1% of the population. That's about 20% of the people. That's a lot of people. Anxiety disorders are highly treatable, yet only, I'm going to just say, about 40% of those suffering receive treatment. People with an anxiety disorder are 3 to 5 times more likely to go to the doctor, 6 times more likely to be hospitalized for psychiatric disorders than those who do not suffer from anxiety disorders. And anxiety disorders develop from a complex set of risk factors, including genetics, brain chemistry, personality, and life events. So as you can see, if you do suffer from anxiety, you are not alone. But this is often something we don't like to share with other people or have other people see. And so it's really interesting, as I sit with clients often, people feel like they're all alone. Nobody else would get the fact that I'm scared that an airplane is going to land on me. Nobody else would get the fact. And then we realize, like, wow, there's a lot of people out there who have these irrational fears as much as I do. And you're not alone in that. Where does anxiety come from? This is kind of the biopsychosocial approach. The biology, what one inherits is a predisposition toward anxiety. It can be seen in early childhood, and it can be in health issues. So for me, I'll just use myself as an example again. My grandma was very anxious. My mom was very anxious. So guess what? Thank you, Mom and Grandma. Sometimes people can feel like, wow, that's really kind of not a very fun thing to get. But I think one of the gifts in it for me is with my own children, I can handle it differently than it was handled with me. And so those of you who might be thinking, oh man, I know I have some anxiety and my kids have anxiety, and how do you create an atmosphere where it's handled differently for them than maybe it was handled for you, if it was handled not that well with you? So your biology is really important, your genetics. Psychology, one's background or experiences, especially in early childhood and within the family. Difficult, chronically stressful, or traumatic experiences in growing up. And so just your whole experience, we're going to talk a little bit about trauma. And then social, current day stressors, just the things that are going on in your everyday life. Here are some types of anxiety. Generalized anxiety disorder, this is when you've had some anxiety. I'm not going to go into all the specifics, but more than 6 months or more. Panic disorder, when you have lots of panic attacks. Phobias, phobias of heights, of spiders, of, you know, all kinds of different things. Separation anxiety. One of the things I just want to add here with thinking about kids with separation anxiety is anxiety is like a muscle. And if your child has a hard time letting you go, let's say you were trying to leave tonight and you decided not to go tonight because your child was really fearful and they didn't want you to go, it's sort of like building that muscle. And I'm not saying this is necessarily true in every case, but I think thinking about, do we want our kids' anxiety muscles to grow, or do we want to show them you've got what it takes to be able to do this? I think is really important. And then social anxiety. Again, some of you here may have social anxiety, and it was a really big deal for you to show up tonight. And then a word about trauma. So I think it's easy to take, not easy, but anxiety can be thought of as what anxiety is, but anxiety can also be something that came out of trauma. Trauma is a normal response to a set of totally abnormal experiences. So people can feel so not normal when they've had trauma, but they're really responded in a very normal way to something that should have never happened to them. And what that does is it puts an imprint on our nervous system, which can create anxiety. Some of you may be thinking, well, I haven't really had any traumas. We think about, you know, abuse or rape or war or those sorts of things. But trauma is something that everybody experiences as a part of life. You coming out of the womb was trauma. It was warm there. Someone was feeding you. There wasn't anybody to bother you. And so coming out into the stark cold, have to breathe on your own sort of world, is a trauma in and of itself. But it can also be something like losing people, dear people to us, being in an accident, seeing an accident, having some sort of a health issue. Maybe there's some sort of relational trauma, a divorce, or something happening with a child can be a piece of that. And much of trauma is also secondary exposure, meaning something that you saw happen to somebody else. It doesn't necessarily have to be something that happened to you. And then developmental trauma. It can happen during childhood. Some things that are downloaded onto our brain and into our system, and even before we even have words, even in the womb, can be traumatizing to us. So I brought my brain, which I'm sure you're glad of. And so I just want to show you a little something here about our brain. Our brain has 1 to 4 quadrillion synaptic connections. So 1 to 4. I think this, to me, is like just blows me away how good God is in making our brain so complex. So that is 1 billion times 1 million. So there's this guy, David Grand, says, and I'm going to believe him, that there's more connections in the brain than there are stars in the universe. So it's an amazing processing machine that all of you have while you're here. But what happens when you get traumatized, this amazing processing machine gets overwhelmed and it breaks down. And I'm going to show you this in just a second. And part of the trauma gets frozen in the brain. So it might be that something happened to you, and Claudio is going to go a little bit more into this, I think, or a piece of this. But your thinking brain is up here. And then your limbic system is sort of in the middle, and your brainstem is here. And so those things get frozen in the limbic system. And I'm going to make a little plug, because I just am so excited about this new, it's sort of a cutting-edge brain therapy. Is it okay if I do this? I can't help myself. called brain spotting. And what it is it's a therapy approach that helps us get into where our negative experiences and our trauma are in our brain. There's a lot of sort of complexities to it, and yet it's very simple, and I'm not going to go into it, except to say that if you have a trauma that you've been living with for years, this is an amazing sort of way to get at it. And I have seen and have experienced myself God's amazing work in people through this. When we don't clear our trauma, and I'm going to have you go to the next slide. This is from a guy named Peter Levine. We have undischarged traumatic stress. So we get stuck either on or off. And maybe you can find yourself there if you've had trauma. The stuck off is more the depression piece of it. The stuck on is anxiety, panic, hyperactivity, exaggerated startle. You can't relax, you're restless, digestive problems, chronic pain, sleeplessness, that fits more into the anxiety. So I felt like it was important to share this piece with you to show you that anxiety can be much more complex than anxiety. Trauma can add a great big piece to it. So I'm going to stop there and let Claudio take over.
And I was thinking that one of the symptoms of anxiety is forgetting, and I forgot to say that I'm a marriage and family therapist. But actually, my friend, she said, well, I have to stand up, right? And in my case, when I'm anxious, I have to walk. So it's interesting, I was preaching at church, and then after I preached, and the person who was videotaping, he said, well, I had trouble following you because you were walking so much. So it's kind of to dissipate my anxiety. But I was thinking that maybe today I'm going to have to run. But anyway, so I'm going to talk about the brain a little bit and kind of continue talking about the brain. So, and the parts that I want to talk more are the cerebral cortex and the amygdala. So the amygdala is the part of the brain that has to do with anxiety, especially feelings such as anger and fear. And when we are in our amygdala, or when we are anxious, we have trouble thinking in a rational way. And the thinking part has to do with the cerebral cortex. And here's an explanation. It's from Daniel Goleman from the book Emotional Intelligence. Yes. So he was explaining that when we become anxious for something, so let's say that we see a rat here, as we are saying, right? Or maybe a bear. That would be a little bit more appropriate. So the information, the sensory information, goes to a part of our brain called thalamus. And then the thalamus is going to send this information to the amygdala and also the cerebral cortex. But the interesting part is that the path to the amygdala is shorter. So this the neural pathway, because it's shorter, it goes faster. And then the amygdala is going to assess for threat. So if the amygdala assesses for threat, and it's going to block or hijack the cerebral cortex, so we don't think, we have an unthinking response. And it's interesting because it differs from each one of us, and it depends on how anxious we are, the traumatic experiences that we had in our throughout our life. So some people, they will react more intensely to some things that happen. And also sometimes with these reactions, when we think later, oh, what did I do? Oh, I shouldn't have done that. But the thing is that we couldn't think really, you know, at that time, we couldn't think rationally. It was just we acted out of our anxiety. Okay, so there is a sympathetic nervous system, and there is also the parasympathetic nervous system. So I just put the sympathetic nervous system here because it works in opposite way of the parasympathetic nervous system. So the sympathetic nervous system has to do with the fight and flight response. So when you are anxious, when you are triggered, so your heart rate increases, such as mine right now, your liver will release glucose, and then several things we cannot see here, but also digestion will kind of be delayed, because if you are in danger, it's better to do that later, right? And also, for example, such as children, they have, so some people, when they are anxious, they urinate a lot, and children, sometimes they have, I don't know the pronunciation, enuresis, I don't know, but when they urinate at night while they are sleeping. And the reason is also, if you are in danger, it's better if you have your bladder empty, right? So you can run. And so some people have also digestive problems, such as esophagitis and irritable bowel syndrome. So a lot of problems happen in our body because of anxiety. So talking about the neocortex, and I'm going to talk about a little bit about children. So this is my specialty. I work with a lot of kids. So the neocortex has to do with self-control, or the control of our emotions. So when we are very anxious, we have difficulty controlling our emotions. Also, empathy, taking into account the feelings of others, or putting ourselves in people's shoes. So let's say that your spouse says something that you get angry, and when you get angry, you want to defend yourself. So it's very hard to put yourself in your spouse's shoes. Oh, my spouse, you know, my spouse has some problems from childhood. They should understand. They should be compassionate. It's very hard to be compassionate when you are anxious. The compassion goes to the space, right? You just kind of get angry. So making sound decisions. So people with anxiety, sometimes they have a hard time making decisions. Moral perception. So it's very interesting that kind of, for example, kids, when they have a problem, when they are anxious, so they do some dumb things, even adults, right? But because it's hard to have a moral perception, understanding oneself. And it's very interesting because if you guys see there in self-control, controlling emotions, but the person with anxiety also has a hard time recognizing his or her feelings, knowing what he or she feels. And it's also interesting because an investigation that they did, when people were kind of sad or they were fearful or some kind of feeling, if someone mentioned their feeling to them, said a word about their feeling, or if they mentioned themselves, the feeling all of a sudden would go down. So kind of being aware of your feelings, talking about your feelings, processing them, someone using empathy with you and talking about your feelings helps you also to regulate your feelings. And also problem with attention. So for example, kids with anxiety, they have sometimes difficulty paying attention. Now, stimulating the amygdala. So one thing of the person, the anxious person or the person who has trauma, is that the person has a very activated amygdala. And what parents sometimes do that activate their children's amygdala, and not all only to children, but to everyone, when you yell to someone, when you criticize, when you scold, if the child is isolated, not only children, we too, if you are isolated. This is why I say that the timeout for children is not good, because children need to be connected. They need to be close to an adult. When they feel connected, their anxiety goes down. So if you isolate a child, the child will actually be more anxious. And as I showed you, if the child is anxious, it's harder for the child to have a moral perception. And actually, sometimes we tell the child to have a timeout, and we want the child to think about what you did. And sometimes what the child is thinking is how bad we are, right? Okay, being physically present but emotionally distant. So it's very important to be emotionally present. Someday, like a kid was complaining about the mother because the mother is all the time at the cell phone. And the kid, like when the kid sees the mother using the cell phone, holding the cell phone, the kid is already upset because that means isolation and means anxiety. Punishing. So, and it's spanking. So it's very interesting. Oh, there's one more thing, I think. Yeah, lecturing. So it's so interesting that sometimes we do all of these things because we want the child to behave appropriately. We want the child to make good choices. So we criticize, we punish, we spank, and we think that this is gonna give a good result. One mother was telling me one of these days, you know, I tell him all the time what he should do. I tell him I'm lecturing, teaching all the time, and he does all the opposite. But what happens? She's stimulating the child's amygdala with criticism, with lecture. The child is feeling unloved. The child is kind of having that sense of a threat. I'm not loved here. I'm being criticized. Someone is against me. I have to defend myself. So what happens? It's the opposite that the parent thinks. Okay, now how we stimulate the neocortex? It's through emotional connection. Not only to children, but to everyone. When we feel close to someone, when we are cared and loved by someone, it helps us to be less anxious. One thing is naming the feelings, as I said. For example, you have a child that is really upset, and then you say, oh, you're really upset. Oh, it seems like you are really angry at me right now, right? So that helps the child to feel better. Also listening. So this is why lecturing a child, not only a child, but an adult as well, is not positive. Because when you lecture, the child, you don't give the child an opportunity to talk about what he or she feels and process the feelings. Also, speaking softly and slowly in a loving tone of voice. It's also very interesting that sometimes parents think that they need to have authority, and authority means yelling and being strong, but it's the opposite. It's being friendly, speaking a loving and slowly tone of voice, touching, hugging, kissing, caressing, using endearing words such as honey, sweetie, dear. It's very interesting also that parents who didn't have these in their childhood, they have difficulty expressing love, showing affection. And affection has to do with connection, and it lowers, it regulates our feelings. And also expressing affection to our family members and other people, getting down to the child's level, kind of, if you kneel down, if you, you know, have eye to eye with the child, with a loving face, smiling, having a friendly face. Okay, so let's go ahead. So I want to talk a little bit about self-regulation. See that children, they cannot regulate their feelings. They are everywhere with their feelings. They are very dramatic, right? If they fall down, they will cry and yell. And sometimes the parent says, oh, get up. Don't worry about that. That's nothing. So you want to teach the child to face and kind of face problems and not worry about things. But actually, it doesn't help much. And I want to tell you about normal versus anxious. So you guys see the lower line there? So let's say that would be the normal person. Okay, so the person is kind of calm here, and then the person comes to this church to give a lecture about anxiety. And then the heart is kind of beating really fast here. So then it goes up, right? And then after the talking, going the way home, and then it's kind of going down and then relaxes. But think about the person with anxiety, that suffers from anxiety, that has chronic anxiety. So the person is a little bit high already. The person has some anxiety even before facing a threat. And then when something happens, the person will go higher than a normal person and will stay there longer. I was watching a video. I don't know if you guys have heard about The Strange Situation. You guys know, right? The Strange Situation is a kind of an experiment that Mary Ainsworth was the first person who did with children and their mothers. So babies 1 year old, they would stay, kind of, they were with their mother in a room and they were playing. And then the mother would leave the room and then the mother would come back. And there were the secure children, the child would cry while the mother would go, and when the mother would come back, would pick up the child and comfort the child, and very soon the child was relaxed and the child would resume playing. But then there was the anxious child. The mother left and the mother came back, and then the mother picked up the child and tried to comfort the child, but the child couldn't really feel comforted. And the child would be upset and sometimes slap the mother, throw a toy down. So it took longer for the child to come down, to regulate the feelings. And now imagine that this child grows up. And now let's say that there's a problem in the marriage. And then the spouse who hurts that person says, oh, no, I'm so sorry. I'm so sad about what I did to you. Oh, you're sad, nothing. I don't believe you. You don't love me. You don't care about me. So the person cannot really kind of regulate their feelings, even if someone is trying to help him or her. Okay, so about self-regulation has to do with view of self, view of other, and seeking comfort. So imagine that you have a child And the child falls down, as I said. And then you pick up the child and you say, oh, honey, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, that's hard. Right? I'm here. I love you. Okay, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. So what happens? This comfort is being printed in the child's brain. And as you comfort this child over and over, and it's imprinting this comforting, and what happens? This child will have the ability of self-regulating, because this is going to stay in the brain. And when we become adults, if something happens to us, we go to that implicit memory. Implicit memory is memory that we cannot recall what happened, but it's there in our brain. It's registered there. And also, something very important happens is that we have a view of self, that we deserve to be loved. We deserve to be comforted, and we have a view of others that we can trust them. We can open our heart to them. We can talk to them about our feelings, and that they will comfort us. So it's very good for self-regulation, because we imagine that the worst thing with people sometimes with anxiety is that they don't trust that they deserve to be cared for someone. So they keep things inside. So when you trust that someone loves you, that you deserve to be loved, you will seek someone. You're not going to be alone in this world. And then you're going to receive the comfort that you are looking for. Thank you.
So I'm going to be talking about anxiety specifically with teens, and this is kind of a fragile life stage with a lot of changes, and I love working with teens. One third of adolescents suffer with anxiety, some type of anxiety disorder, and it's commonly overlooked because there's not very many bad behaviors that come from it. So it's not taken as seriously, but it is something that's very prevalent, especially in the Bay Area. So there's a wide range of presentations that that people with anxiety have, and so it can be the student who is sitting there quietly, kind of an isolated suffering, or it could be the person that says, I have a test next period, and I am freaking out over it. And so so it comes in all sorts of presentations, and so it really just depends on the personality of the teenager. Next is there's a wide range of academic levels. So someone with anxiety might not be able to finish their homework because it's too difficult and they're really anxious about it. But it could also be the person who's getting straight A's in all the AP classes, and they suffer from anxiety too. And also, there's a wide range of reasons, especially in this life stage. There's so many different types of new experiences, from friendships to dating, college applications, and academic stress. They have more responsibilities at home and higher expectations, and also family life can bring anxiety too. So there's a whole spread. Specific to this life stage is identity formation. And teenagers are still trying to figure out who they are, and it's a process. So they're jumping into really uncomfortable situations and trying new things. And so they may go out for a sport that they don't know if they're good at or not, but they're giving it a try, and that shows a lot of growth. And so as parents, it's good to empathize with the fear and anxiety that they might have around trying new things, but also to encourage them to grow and try those new things. And that's how you mature. also is social comparison happens a lot with teenagers. So before they may, when they were children in elementary school or middle school, they may have been having anxiety over mastering new skills for themselves, but now it's a stage of comparing. So along with identity, they're forming their social groups, they're seeing who's popular, who's better in classes than them, and that can cause a lot of anxiety too, especially if you're still trying to figure out who you are and what classes you're good in or not. And then next is friendships are really important in this life stage too. Whereas they may have gone to their parents for anxiety, in this life stage, they count on their friends too, and they become like their friends. So what their friends are worrying about is also what they're going to be worrying about as well. And in this stage, they start to differentiate from their parents. The cliche rebellious teenager happens, and so they may have different values that they're experimenting with, and have disagreements with their parents. I encourage parents to still stay engaged in this time, because it can kind of seem like teens are, not listening to them or don't need them, but this is a really important time for you to just stay engaged and still be an emotional support, like Claudio had stated. And then lastly, I'm going to talk about social media because it does play a part in anxiety as well. Social media can be a way to avoid. So you can escape to your phone and miss out on social situations or uncomfortable interactions like waiting in line. But it also can provoke anxiety as well. Going back to the social comparison piece, it's just another way to compare yourself to others. And so just keeping a gauge of how you're avoiding situations and using social media for that, and then also the comparing aspect brings anxiety.
All righty. Aren't these guys great?
Not easy to follow all this brilliance. And so,
thank you.
So what I'm going to actually do is kind of dumb this thing down here for a moment. I got a question that I want to ask you. Whoever gets it right wins this. What color is this?
Yellow.
Yes. Who answered yellow? I think you did. You're the winner in pink. There you go. Free gift. Okay. When you think of yellow, what does it symbolize? Slow down. Hey, do we have any Simon and Garfunkel fans out here? You remember the song, Slow Down What? We've got to what? Oh, come on, let's sing this. Come on now. Slow down, we move too fast. Make the morning last just. You guys are great. I want you to just reflect for a moment on the idea of slowing down. What do you notice within yourself from the sense of slowing down? Perhaps a little more in control, a little more peace. Richard Foster wrote a book years ago called Celebration of Discipline. Did anybody ever read that book? He started off the book with, "Hurry is not of the devil, it is the devil." We live in such a fast-paced society. What I want to invite you to do for a moment is everybody just kind of bow your head and close your eyes. And in this moment of quietness, I just want to invite you to be aware of the presence of God within our being, as well as we are in His presence and how good and fortunate this is. What I also want to invite you to do for a moment is do the best you can to just take a deep breath or two. And a deep breath goes something like this. Do the best you can to inhale as deeply as you can. Hold it for a count of one. And just exhale slowly. Just do it once or twice. Notice the lightness that you feel within. A little bit of peace. Deep breathing exercises the heart to release endorphins, to help bring a little bit more calm within our being. You can open your eyes. I also want to invite you to take a moment tonight just to have a sense of being aware. What I'm about to share with you tonight is a process for a few years that I feel very fortunate and blessed to have learned to be able to help in a practical way, be able to deal with difficult thoughts, emotions, etc. I've spent a lot of my life struggling, even in my faith, questioning the weakness of my faith, or where was it, with many difficult, anxious, depressing moments. But in the early 90s, I read a book that helped give me a greater perspective about awareness, and I think the thing that I really appreciated about learning to become aware, it became a tool to help unhook difficult emotions, anxiety, depression from getting the best of me. But the best part about learning to become aware and unhooking is that it gave me a greater sense for the presence of God. A lot of clients will say, well, Rob, I'm already aware of how I'm feeling and how I'm thinking. And I go, yeah, I know. But you may not be really as aware of what you're really doing with all your difficult thoughts and emotions. The classic expression, it's not the problem is not really the problem. The problem is what we are doing with the problem, and we don't even realize it. So part of awareness is learning to become more observant of our God-created selves, and learning how to have a wiser response to the internal struggle that we experience. I think that even Jesus was really the author of mindfulness when he taught us to watch and to pray. All right, go ahead, next one. Okay, attitude. So as we're learning to become aware, I try to encourage an attitude of openness, learning to be receptive, and key is learning to be patient in our experience. The next one, ability. Paul wrote Timothy in his second book. I'm sure you're all familiar with the verse that says, for we weren't given a spirit of fear, but of power, love, and self-discipline. And that was a verse that bothered me for many years, because whenever I came across it, I always felt fear, And I certainly never felt powerful. And it bothered me. And then one day I finally looked up the word power, and to my shock and amazement and excitement, especially in what we do, the Greek definition for power is ability. And I thought that was so fantastic, because to realize that God has really given us an ability to really deal with psychological issues in ways that we would have never imagined. So I try to encourage, learn to know your God-given confidence and being able to process and continue as we're going along here. Okay, the next one, learning to allow, which is really learning to give yourself permission to experience your emotions. I think the key is learning to allow yourself to be willing. The next one, acceptance. I'm sure you're familiar with the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change what I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's not that we change what is going through our mind, but what we can change is our response to the internal struggle or the internal experience of anxiety and depression. All right. So the next one, or the face and the, go ahead in the one after that as well. Okay. So the challenge really is learning to face and acknowledge, because our tendency when we're struggling with an anxiety or depression is to want to do what I call the fight or flight syndrome. Or we could freeze up, or we try to control, or fight to make go away, which is a normal tendency. And actually, when we do that, we actually make ourselves feel a whole lot worse. What I find in my experience is that most people have the tendency to either minimize their experience by usually saying, no, it's not that big a deal, or catastrophize or overreact as if something will never change or they'll never get over it. So the next, and I think to me this is sort of semi the heart, is learning how to flow with what you feel. Learning how to notice more of what you're experiencing in your anxiety that gives you better potential, go ahead, to figure out what the real cause is. A lot of times when clients come in, I'll ask them, well, what do you think you're really anxious about or depressed about? Now, one thing I think is really important to qualify tonight is that I know that there are some very severe situations or conditions. So what I'm speaking or addressing is a very general way to be able to deal with or respond to the internal struggle of anxiety or depression. If we are doing the above, learning to be aware, learning to have an attitude of openness and flexibility, learning to allow ourselves and accept and get out of the fight or flight syndrome, that we will have better potential to figure out what the cause is. And then the more that we are able to figure out what the cause is will also give us better potential to figure out what our needed response is or the choice that we need to make. And then I think one more. And if we learn this process, one of my favorite verses is where Paul wrote in Galatians, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. So it's really not about getting rid of anxiety or getting rid of depression. It's really about better understanding what it's about, how to respond to it. And if we learn this process, I think that we can learn how to get out from underneath the heavy burden of anxiety and depression. And that's pretty much it as a short process, what I try to work with clients through in my practice. So anyway, that's it.
And then there's just one last slide from John 14:27. And these were some of Jesus' last words before he went to heaven. And it says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. I did not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid." And just thinking about Jesus giving us his peace. And I think if there's anything we want you to take away from here tonight is that Jesus is with you in your anxiety or in your fear or in your depression or whatever it is that you're struggling with, that you're not alone. And, you know, I know we're going to go through a question and answer session, and you may or may not get your questions answered. But just it's so important to know that, that you're not alone in whatever it is you're facing.
Okay, well, I want to invite you now to go ahead and hopefully you've had a chance, if you have a question, go ahead if you want, you can fold it in half. And why don't you pass those toward the middle? And Sean and Jim are going to trot right up here and gather those up right quick because we want to have time to do some Q&A. So if you go ahead, pass them to the edge. And then if you haven't had time but you want a couple minutes, we are going to take a little break and they'll leave the basket in the back. I know I've got some questions, and if you haven't asked them, I probably will. So even if we don't get too many, I'll come up with some, because I've got a few. But why don't we take, because we're running a little bit behind where I thought we would, but it's no worries. Let's take about 8 minutes instead of 10, take a little break, and then we will come back together and do some Q&A. So I hope you can stick around. Cut the music. Thank you. We had lots of questions. We probably won't get through them all, but we're going to do our best to haul through these. We may not be able to give as lengthy of an answer as you want, but we will do our best to touch upon a lot of them, and we'll just go from there. All right. One thing that I think would be good to start with is the question of how do you know when it's time to get some help? You know, the difference between, is this, we put on the flyer, you know, am I just stressed out or do I really have something here I should go and see someone with? So can you give us just a little idea of how do I know when I need to go get some help?
I think, I honestly think everyone needs to, it's helpful. I mean, we have therapists, it's helpful. But I think when it really is impeding your everyday life, and you wake up and it's one of the first things you think about, it's going through your head at nighttime. Obviously, there's the more severe cases where you really need some help. So I think when it's really getting in the way of your daily living, that's when you should seek help.
Okay. So it affects your daily life, kind of. So people asked about how do I help someone else with anxiety, from my child to my friend to my grandchild. How do I help? It's a big question. Can we get a...
You know what I would say for a moment, because we as Christians are very genuine and usually know the right verse to want to give. Mm-hmm. And the irony is that sometimes that's the last thing that we want to hear. I know that I think the best thing that we can do is just be a presence and listen. Because sometimes more than anything, we just need to be able to give voice. I do. If I wasn't clear earlier, I'm not without my own experience still of experiencing anxiety, depression, anger, stress. I've just been fortunate to learn and still have moments where I can get really overwhelmed. But anyway, I think that one of the most profound things is, it's funny, it's like when couples end up at my office It's like the number one complaint is, she never listens to me, he never listens to me. But you know, we all want a listening heart and someone to be present.
I was going to say also with kids, and Claudio talked a little bit about this, but the idea of just noticing their anxiety, saying to them, wow, this is really hard for you, or wow, I notice you're really frustrated about this. Not fixing the problem for them, but just noticing it. We all like to have our emotions noticed. The other thing I think is presence, as Rob said, but also with a friend, with somebody else, maybe asking them, what does support look like for you right now? Just simply asking that question. And some people will say, I just want you to be here. Some others will say, I'll let you know if I need anything, or, you know, I have to go to, you know, XYZ event, will you come with me? But what does support look like right now, I think, is a really good question to ask. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would you want me to do to support you right now? Mm-hmm. Good. There was a question about anxiety and its relationship to depression and OCD.
You know, it's kind of interesting that where I think sadly over the years where it becomes chronic is because we've never really learned how to process the initial onset of anxiety or depression. People can be depressed from anticipating for their anxiety, can be anxious over the depression. So it's all cyclical. So they all, there's an interweave. So I don't think you just, some people can be more pronounced, I think, with anxiety or with depression. But it's part of how God has wired us for good reason. That, again, the challenge is to make sense of what it's really about and how to cope and respond.
I think the OCD piece of it is, is that book called Brain Lock? There's a book called Brain Lock, I believe. Someone's nodding yes. And it talks a lot about how your brain gets stuck in these patterns, these cyclical patterns of you get obsessed about something. And, you know, it might be, there's kind of the stereotypical one of, you know, checking the doors, and then the compulsion is to go check the doors. You're anxious, like I'm laying in bed at night and I need to make sure that the door is locked, or I need to make sure that I've washed my hands, and so those types of things make you anxious. And so definitely, I think, again, as Rob said, they're all so interweaved that sometimes it's hard to tease them all apart.
Okay. Couple of parenting related ones. If timeout is not a good option, what are other ways to discipline, especially for a toddler?
Well, I am a Love and Logic trained facilitator, and so I would go the Love and Logic route, which is, I don't want to get into the whole thing, but the idea of leading with empathy. And what does that sound like for a child? Uh-oh, so sad. Looks like you need a little time away. And our first inclination, as Claudio was talking about, is to get angry. Most of our parents got angry. But really what we're doing is we're providing empathy, because we know that empathy allows it to be our child's problem and not our problem. We're teaching them from the very get-go to own what is theirs. And so it's sort of Love and Logic's version of a timeout, which allows our child to own responsibility for being in a timeout. But it really is different how we approach it from a not angry place, but from an empathetic place. A, wow, this is really sad that you made this choice, and now there are consequences to be had. And it's very counterintuitive to go in with a child in a empathetic way versus an angry way. So if you, whoever has that question, Love and Logic is a great parenting tool that I have used a ton and think it's great. So did you?
Yeah, I also want to talk about something that I read from Daniel Siegel. I don't know if you guys have heard about him, but he is a pediatrician and psychiatrist, and he has several books written on parenting. And he says that when a child misbehaves, and sometimes we think that we need to right away kind of punish, scold, and be hard on the child, But he said that the first thing is to connect. So think about this. When a child misbehaves, generally the child is in the amygdala. The child is not thinking properly, right, rationally. And it's very common for children because the neocortex, which is the part of the brain that thinks and processes logic, that develops about when we are 25 years old. And that means that especially with children, they have these struggles and we have to be more patient with them. And so when they misbehave, the first thing is to calm their brain, talk to them, listen to them, use all those tools of connection that I showed you guys. Then when the child now is calmed, when the child is more relaxed, now you can talk about what the child did. But when you talk about that, try to listen to the child and talk about the feelings, as you were saying, like empathizing, process with what happened to the child. And then you can also help the child to have empathy towards someone that the child might have hurt. So how do you think your brother feels because of what you did, or you broke his toy? How do you think he might feel right now? Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. I don't care. Well, can you look at him? Do you think that he seems happy right now? Yeah, he's crying. Mm. When you cry, how do you feel? Oh, I'm sad. Oh, so how do you think he feels? Well, he might be sad. So in a conversation like this, very kind of in a conversation that is non-judgmental, kind of accepting with patience, because think that you want to work with the neocortex instead of the amygdala.
Okay. Can you rebel in your 20s against your parents or even in your 30s? And can your rebellion in teens last until your 20s? Yeah. How long can we call it rebellion, I guess? Teen rebellion. Any thoughts on that?
Yes.
It can go on and on. There's not really
I think no matter what age you are, you rebel against your parents. I mean, I'm, you know, I won't tell you exactly how old I am, but I feel like still there's things I do that are like, ooh, this will be fun to try out. You know, I mean, I think it's natural and very normal. I think it's kind of fun.
Maybe not the one who's in the parent play.
This is true.
It's like, are they ever going to stop rebelling against me? Maybe not, right? That's maybe the answer.
That's a hard question because it's so, yeah. I mean, maybe it depends a lot on the relationship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, with anxiety and negative thoughts playing over and over, how do you stop these negative thoughts from coming? Knowing that they're not healthy isn't always connected to the emotion that plays over and over again. So how do you stop those negative thoughts from coming?
You don't. That's what I love about mindfulness and getting unhooked. I mean, it's difficult because we have to remember, I mean, I will often say we live in terrible conflict every single day. I mean, we're saints and sinners at the same time. And I think we do live in tension, but I think it's the grace to be able to notice. And it's really, again, learning how to, for example, you know, it's common is like, I try not to be so affected or I shouldn't feel this way. And I say, well, but you do. And again, the more you try to fight it to actually, or even your thoughts, the worse you're going to make yourself feel. But what's interesting is through radical acceptance or the serenity prayer, when you learn to acknowledge the difficult thoughts, it's okay to say, oh, I hate this. It's okay to be honest about it. But you know what you learn to do? You learn to go, okay, it's there. Not fun. You know, the some of the common phrases are, you just got to learn how to get over it. You just got to learn to deal with it. These kinds of things. And you know what the weird part is like it doesn't really work. This is where I say the Beatles had it right. Let it be. And you know what? What's kind of interesting, too, because we get so tied up in knots. But the weird part is you're going to forget that you were struggling with it anyway, and it's going to change, and you're going to move beyond it, actually, to a whole nother set, because this is life, okay? So you know what's actually incredibly freeing is to learn, like, okay, there it goes again, another mind trip. And you know, in a way, it's like what I love to be able to share is it's sort of like a testimony after all these years, is you just sort of get used to just flowing along with it. But you know what I think is also key too, in one sense to combat is, I forgot to mention earlier, is meditation. So it's one thing to be mindful, but I love Psalm 1. Are you all familiar with Psalm 1? Now think about the imagery for a moment when you think of Psalm 1. Blessed is he who meditates day and night. For when we meditate on the law, in the life of God, we will be like trees planted by streams of living water, whose leaf does not wither. And whatever we do, we prosper because the mind is aware of the presence of God, knowing Jesus within, being compelled and inspired by his love and wisdom to respond to these very difficult things. So I think that's my challenge every single morning is constantly remembering things like his divine power gives me everything that I need for life and godliness. Stay meditative. So for me, it's really a combo. It's learning to be mindful as a way to cope, but also meditating upon in order to maintain sanity, live life well, and be able to. And the other thing, too, is that all of this is so that we can be more effective servants. And be able to love more wholesomely. So.
Go ahead.
Okay. Just to expand on that, with the negative thoughts, I think being curious about them and where they came from, trying to trace back the first time that you had that fear or the negative thought about yourself, if there's some sort of shame that you had felt earlier on, and now it's just repeating itself, and just going back in your mind to retrace the steps. It's good too.
I think too, actually I was thinking about yesterday, I have triplets actually, and they're 14 years old, and I was like the worst possible mother yesterday. That's how I felt. And so I kept going through this thing in my head. I'm such a terrible mom. What have I done to have these kids go wrong? They're just, nobody's doing what I should have taught them to do, and kind of this downward spiral. And I think to remember, like, what does it look like to be compassionate to myself in that moment? And to say to myself instead, you know what? We're in a difficult stage of life here. We're in teenagehood or whatever you call it, and it's hard. I am struggling with being a mom right now. I'm struggling with not feeling great about the job that I'm doing. And being kind to myself about that. And it doesn't mean, you know, oftentimes when I talk to clients about this, they'll say, like, it feels so Pollyannish, right? Like, well, it's all just fine. But it's not doing that. It's being very real. Like, wow, this is really hard. I'm really having a hard time. What do I need to do right now to help myself through this? Or who do I need to talk to? Or how do I just notice that this is what I'm feeling? And I think, too, like, I think about anxiety as sort of, you know, that was actually more shaming negative thoughts maybe, but anxiety too is sort of a wave. Like, it comes in just as a wave does, and then it goes back. I know when it's coming. I see it sometimes, not always. Sometimes it's like right on top of me and like, oh, here I am. But sometimes I see it coming like, okay, I see you there. I know what you look like. I know what happens in my body when you're there. And now what am I going to do to take good care of myself? Because I maybe can't avoid you. You're going to come no matter what. But I have to take good care of myself in that process.
It's hard sometimes to love ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we are only thinking of how to love the others, but sometimes we can love ourselves and the other person. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask Dr. Fu a question. If he would come up for a second and grab a mic, because I think dovetailing off that question, we know that there are times when these negative thoughts
go beyond and maybe some of these other things aren't working. And it goes to one of these next questions. What meds are most effective to address anxiety?
So there are different types of medications. Typically, we try to put people on the antidepressants that are also anti-anxieties, like the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, SSRIs for short. And some of the names you're familiar with, Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, Celexa, they're excellent for four conditions: depression, anxiety, panic attacks, OCD. So they work for these four conditions. Some people cannot take these medications because they're sensitive to side effects. Some people, such as, for example, if you have bipolar disorder, you need to be very careful about giving people with this condition antidepressants, because then the hypomania could flare up. Another type of medication that would work for anxiety are the benzodiazepines, like Klonopin, Lorazepam, Xanax. But we need to be careful about these types of medications because they have addictive potentials. One of the advantages is they can be used as needed. You don't have to take it every day. But with the SSRIs, you have to take it every day for it to work. So you really need to assess the patient. What are their needs? What is appropriate? And I always tell the patients, medication is not a do-all, be-all magic pill. There's no such thing. You need to couple that with therapy, because that's really the backbone of the treatment. It's the therapy. If you learn how to cope with your anxiety along with the medication, your prognosis for getting better is much better. But if you only do medications, you don't learn how to cope with the source of anxiety, you take away the medication, almost 100% the anxiety will return, because you never learned how to deal with it.
Good, thank you.
I just want to say, along with Dr. Fu, we're creatures of need, and our needs vary. There's no shame in medication. Medication, I believe God has his hand on, that can be very useful and helpful. I think what is important is to do a balance of therapy along with meds. So meds definitely has its place, and one person has this need, another person has this need. We're creatures of need in various forms. So,
absolutely.
And another reason for medication is if the patient has high anxiety, and you tell them to go to therapy, but they can't even begin to process what the therapist is trying to tell them. Or they go home, the therapist gives them assignments, they come back, they can't do it because their anxiety is so high. And therapy takes time to work, so you need something that will work faster to bring down the level of anxiety so they can work with the therapist to get better.
Good. So, question about postpartum anxiety along with other anxiety disorders, and the postpartum anxiety too can be crippling. So please comment on resources for new mothers and how to cope with that anxiety along with sleep deprivation. So for the new mommies. With triplets, I'm sure you dealt with sleep deprivation.
Well, you know, I would just say, don't wait long to get help. You know, I don't know, Dr. Fu, if you have anything to add, to, or anybody else for that matter, but I think it's something that we maybe feel shame about, or that it shouldn't happen to us, but it's very real. It's very, and it's something that I think we need to really take seriously. And so, my suggestion would be to just get help. And maybe that doesn't look like therapy. Maybe that looks like a support group or talking to other friends who have had kids and finding out what are you going through. But I guess my biggest answer to that would be, don't wait too long to get help, and it's okay to get help.
Mm-hmm. If you don't treat postpartum anxiety or depression, the mother is unable to take care of the baby, and the mother's emotional state will transfer to the child, and that's very important to treat. And there's also the misconception that when you are breastfeeding, you cannot take medication. That's really not true. There are safe ways to administer medications for women who are nursing. it's even worse if you don't treat it, because then you can't be an effective mother, and then that drives the guilt.
I think that helps with the other question.
May I say something about this too? See that children, they are so able to pick up on parents' feelings. And one thing that happens with parents, and in the case especially mothers, when they have depression or anxiety, is that they are in their heads. So they have difficulty to being present for the child, because whatever they are worried about, or if they are sad, they are inside of themselves and not able to be present for the child. So it's very important to get treatment to be really present for the children.
Okay. When a family member is furiously anxious and angry and refuses to communicate and no words can break in, what can we do when they're totally closed in and the family member is a non-believer? Not sure that. Yeah. So what to do when a family member is furiously angry and anxious and no words can break in? It reminds me of the curve that you made.
Yeah, I would say that it's very anxiety-provoking.
Yes.
Because especially anxious people, and I include myself, it's so hard sometimes to deal with someone who is upset and maybe silent. You want to fix the situation, right? You want to do something about it. And sometimes we need to accept that, wait for the person to feel better, and we can tell the person, you know, I am here. I know it's very hard what's happening to you right now, but you know, I'm open to talk to you. I love you. I'm interested about helping you, and whenever you want to talk, I am here to listen to you. And then you wait there. I know that it's kind of sometimes torturing, right? When someone is upset and you want so fast to fix the situation. But think about this, that just being present with a person, showing that you care, that's a lot already, you know? And avoid blaming or giving advice. You know, just show empathy. I know it's hard. I understand. You know, I am here. Whenever you want to talk, I will be here to listen to you.
Just one other quick thing I was going to say about that, too. I think it's important if you're the person asking that question to figure out how you're going to deal with your discomfort in that, because it's hard when you're in a place when you can't control what's going on over there. We don't like that. We want to be in control just by the fact that we're humans. And so if you're the person or, you know, in that situation, figuring out, what do I do with my discomfort in this? Because again, going back to Rob's Serenity Prayer, I can only work on me. I can only figure out what I can do and what I can't do.
Good point. A quick one. Can any medication help during an acute anxiety attack? And are there any side effects?
Well, if you want something that will work within 30 minutes to 1 hour when you're having a panic attack, you go for the benzodiazepines like Xanax, lorazepam, Clonopin. They work fast, but they have time limits. How long they are effective, and then once that time passes, the medication's effect is gone. But these also are potentially addictive side effects. They can slow you down mentally. They can make you sleepy. They can slow down your reactions when you're driving. Some more severe, some people can have short-term memory problems. So there are side effects. Before you start these medications, you really need to be assessed whether they are the most appropriate for you, or are there other types of medications that are better for you.
Talk to the doctor.
I have one other thing, too, that for panic attacks, actually, it's not a medication thing, but if you hold your finger like a slit away from your eye and you look at your finger, and you can do this process for like 3 minutes, there are 6 muscles in each of your eye that are connected to your nervous system. And what happens if you look here and then you look at the wall, you look here and you do each one of them for about 10 seconds and you do that for 3 minutes, that actually calms down your nervous system. And many people report that they can stop a panic attack from happening. They can stop one, you know, mid. You can also do it eyes closed, eyes open. But it's a great way to settle down your nervous system in a panic attack.
The worst thing you can do is start drinking.
Yes. I need to ask a favor from someone in the loft before I go on. I think I left my folder up there, so if somebody sees it laying on the table and they could bring it, Jim's on his way. Thank you. So I have 2 questions here that kind of go together. How do you define healthy boundaries and discipline children without adding to their anxiety or traumatizing them? Because you talked about that, being careful not to add to their anxiety. How do you discipline them without doing that? And then a second question that goes kind of right along with it is, the list of behaviors that stimulate the part of the brain for stresses was my childhood. Mm-hmm. So how do I overcome that? So it's kind of both ends of the question. How do I avoid it? What do I do so I don't cause that? And if that did happen, what do I do about it now?
Well, I would say that the first step, well, the chicken or the egg, right? The first step is potentially to heal your own trauma, because really all of those things are traumatic, and they have been downloaded into your implicit memory or maybe your explicit memory. And there's lots of ways to do that. And one of the things that I was talking about earlier is the type of therapy called brain spotting, which is an option. What it does is it clears that trauma for you. Because I think we do what has been done for us. We just kind of go to, unless we really try to figure out something different, we kind of work with what has been done for us. And so I don't know if you have something to add to that. That's just the first thing that sort of came to my brain, is dealing with your own trauma and then figuring out how to do it with your child.
And I think that it's a process, and mm-hmm. therapy helps as well. And also the thing is that if we notice, there are 2 causes of anxiety. One is nature, or like our genetic thing, right, that we receive from our parents. Another thing is nurturing. So how we were, the environment that we lived in, especially the relationship with our parents. And one thing very interesting is that anxiety also, one way of treating anxiety is through relationships. Mm. So what I have seen is that a good relationship is a good remedy for anxiety, although sometimes we might need to have a couples therapy. And what I have noticed with the couples that I help, and it's so interesting. I remember one case, a client, she came to me and she was complaining about depression, and all that she said was about her husband. So then I invited her to bring her husband to therapy. So after a number of sessions, and then I asked her, and what about your anxiety? No, what about your depression? And she said, it has gone. And then after 37 sessions, she left, with a healed from depression and also in a good relationship with her husband. So it's so interesting that like helping to connect to someone, helping to feel really, connected and loved and cherished by that person, lowered her anxiety level. Hmm.
Can you explain a little more the difference between anxiety and worry? And it reminds me that the video that you played at the beginning touched on that. Can you tell us what that was? Because I think that's something people could watch again, correct? It was from YouTube or something? So if you can tell us what that was.
Yes,
again?
It's on YouTube. Secrets of People Living with Anxiety, I believe. But if one of you wants to answer that question, I'll check.
So the difference between anxiety and worry.
Yeah, worry is part of anxiety. And I would say that everyone who has anxiety will worry. It's really kind of hard sometimes to stop worrying. And people who have a tendency to worry, if they wake up in the middle of the night, they just start thinking about things that they have to do, their problems, and their brain is always working, right? But you know, the things that we have talked about and therapy so can help with worry. And something that I think that a question before here is that sometimes people want to stop worrying and it kind of doesn't help. So as we have talked here, kind of accepting yourself, trying to kind of notice your thoughts and your worries and try to emerge in your feelings. Such as, for example, when people have a panic attack, it's so interesting because people have panic attacks because they are worried about their anxiety. So they are fearful of their fear. Mm-hmm. And then they spiral out of control, because if you are worried that you have something very serious and that you might die because of that, guess what? You're going to become even more anxious. And when you become more anxious, then you worry even more. And then it's kind of spiraling. But one thing that works is when you try, instead of escaping from it, instead of fleeing from it or trying to control it, try to emerge in it. Try to think, what am I feeling right now? What is happening to me? What is this fear about? And try to feel the fear. Try to notice it. And it's so interesting that when you do that, the tendency is that you're going to feel better. Because if you try to run from it, it will run after you. Mm-hmm. But if you stay there and you say, anxiety, well, you know, be my guest, I'll sit here, let's talk. thank you so much for coming. I'm so glad that you care about me and so worried about me. You know, I don't need all that worry, but you are welcome. So you befriend it instead of kind of being worried about it and afraid about it, you know. And then when you say it, kind of helps.
That's why earlier I had you encourage you to just take a couple of deep breaths. Yes. You know, because it's hard to experience anxiety when you're deep breathing. And again, if I think what is so key, it's not about trying to be rid or overcome. It's really about being able to be present, breathing with. And you know, it's really interesting. In fact, one of my favorite analogies of difficult emotions is like the weather. You know, it's kind of interesting over the years. I mean, I'll tell people, you'd have better luck to go outside and tell God to change the weather than your emotions. And he says, I won't do that. I've allowed you to experience these emotions for a reason. The challenge is to make sense and understand. And after a while, I think you do start to make sense. And there are times where, again, I think you can get so overwhelmed and flooded that it would be wise of you to do a consult with somebody like Dr. Fu, because I think there can be a season where or myths can be helpful. But I think after a while, see, that's why I encourage, have this sense of learning to just flow with. And sure, sometimes they get uncomfortable, they're not fun. Again, okay to be honest, but the challenge is just to try to not fight or fix or control them.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I think we are about out of time. And so I think... we obviously didn't get through all of your questions, and a few of them were great questions that were much more theologically based questions, and that leads me easily into what I wanted to say as we wrap up, is that on behalf of all of us on the pastoral staff, we are very ready to meet with people when you want to talk to us.
And so some of those kinds of questions, if you had one and you haven't had it answered, I hope that whichever one of us you feel the most connected with or most comfortable with, give us a call, shoot us an email. We are here for you, and we want to meet with you and talk with you, because sometimes pastoral care is what you need. On the other hand, sometimes you really need a licensed therapist, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and we are not those, and we're aware of that. So if you're not sure, you can start with us, and we'll help you to know and kind of weed it out, and we will likely encourage you to go and visit one of these folks or someone that they would recommend. And I would include in that that if financially you're dealing with a very particularly hard time, but you also have some significant things that you need to work through in counseling, talk to us about that too, because we have and continue to help people with the cost of counseling if that is something that you need. So don't write it off because it's expensive, because we would like to help you with that. So thank you very much. Let's just thank our panel. Thank you all. I'd like to just close us in prayer, and then we will be dismissed. So pray with me. Lord God, we just do thank you for this time. Thank you for being with us. Ultimately, we thank you because your grace, you have promised, will be sufficient for us. But we know that life can be hard. It can be actually excruciating at times. And so I pray for those here who are hurting. That perhaps tonight has stirred something up, that you would comfort, that you would bring them a word, and that they would reach out, and that they would talk to others. Thank you that you have planted your Holy Spirit within us, and that we can speak truth to one another, and we can be Jesus to one another. So I pray for that person who might be feeling really hurting, that they would reach out and talk to someone. We thank you that you are on our side, that you are our hope and our strength, and that you are our good, good Father, our rock, our refuge. And so we thank you that you have promised us that nothing can separate us from your love. Not death or life or angels or demons or our fears or our panic attacks or any of our worries about tomorrow or even the powers of hell can separate us from your love. You are our Father. And so we just have to thank you. Thank you for being our Father and for giving us wisdom. And we pray for wisdom tonight as we close, that you would continue to give us wisdom to live this life and that you would grant us peace in it. Thank you for this time. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks.